welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Although she was the most conspicuous reformer of her time, no group wishes to claim Carrie Nation. She fought for women's rights, but feminists dismiss the intensely religious Nation. The religious right disparages her because in the process of becoming a reformer, she deserted her husband. And even the organization that she helped launch, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, no longer claims her as their own because her name conjures up an image of a fanatical, hatchet-wielding saloon buster. Whether any of this is fair or even accurate is the subject of our interview this week with Nation biographer Fran Grace. And President Bush's faith-based initiative has led historian Andrew Schockett to examine instances in the past where government support for religious institutions and social programs has been considered. But before we get to those subjects, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On May 5, 1945, the only American civilians to be killed by the enemy in the continental United States during World War II fell victim to a Japanese bomb. Elsie Mitchell and five children from Lakeview, Oregon, were killed while attempting to drag what appeared to be a harmless balloon from the woods. Unbeknownst to them, the balloon was heavily armed and it exploded soon after they began tampering with it. The balloon that wreaked havoc on Lakeview was one of 9,000 bomb-laden balloons known as Fugo weapons that Japan unleashed in an effort to cause panic in the U.S. Only an estimated 1,000 of the bomb-bearing balloons made it across the Pacific, but they fell in an area stretching from Alaska to Texas and from Oregon to Iowa. They caused little material damage, but in order to neutralize the bomb's potential effect on national morale and to deny Japan knowledge of the effectiveness of its terror weapon, the U.S. government encouraged the press not to publicize balloon bomb incidents. As a result, the Japanese only learned of one bomb reaching Wyoming, which failed to explode, and abandoned the balloon bomb project after only 5 months. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, Reverend Ronald Denton Wilson of Florida recently told the FBI that his father, Henry Clay Wilson, not James Earl Ray, was the man who assassinated Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4, 1968. Although Wilson offers no documents, photographs, or witnesses to support his claim, he confessed to FBI agents that he remained silent for over 30 years because he was waiting until his father and two other men, whom Wilson claimed he witnessed plotting King's murder, died. More than 10 years after his father's death, Reverend Wilson has come forward in an effort, he says, to clear his conscience. A Gutenberg Bible, the first substantial text to be printed by modern printing methods, is going online to allow a worldwide audience to take a close look at the mid-15th century marvel. Using state-of-the-art digital scanning techniques and high-resolution cameras, digitizing specialists hope to capture a highly detailed photographic image of every page of the work. The soon-to-be-digitized Bible, housed in the U.S. Library of Congress, is one of only three perfect copies known to exist. Another copy, housed in the British Library, is already digitized and online. This is Talking History. Carrie Nation, a stout, grandmotherly Kansan, chopped her way onto the front pages of American newspapers and into unprecedented worldwide celebrity status in the early 1900s by attacking saloons with a little hatchet. Today her name conjures up the caricature of an hysterical, pleasure-hating Puritan. Guest today, Fran Grace, suggests in her book, Carrie A. Nation, Retelling the Life, Nation's life is a bit more complicated than that. Fran Grace is a professor of religious studies at the University of Redlands.
Hey.
Fran, you write in your book that Carrie Nation was more than her hatchet. She was and is a folk heroine. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think we have in our heads that Carrie Nation was represented some kind of fringe culture in backwater Kansas, when really her hatchet stood for the voice of the people. She was a vigilante who was trying to stand up to the corrupt politicians because the Kansas citizens had voted that their state be free of alcohol, and there were saloons lining every street, really. And so she was a vigilante who took the law into her hands and really represented the will of the people. So you had thousands of people marching behind her in the streets of Midwestern towns. And, you know, as she said to the Kansas legislators in 1901, after she started her huge Topeka crusade, you're not doing your duty here. You have ignored the people's vote, and you don't give me a vote as a woman to make decisions about things I feel passionate for. So I'm picking up my rocks, crowbars, and I'm going to implement what the people want. So, you know, that's the kind of figure we're talking about, and I like how you reference her as a pleasure-hating Puritan, because we do have that image of her. And sure, she had some things she didn't really like sex and alcohol and what she called the swole-faced, beak-nosed donkey bedmates of Satan. But she was also a very humorous person.
Run that phrase by me again. What was that again?
Swole-faced, beak-nosed, donkey bedmate of Satan. That was how she referred to the people who ran the saloons and the corrupt politicians who supported their illegal activity.
That's a great one. I love
it. Catchy, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. Well, given her representing the will of the people, as you put it, but you also make the point that her assaults on bars were really very shrewdly calculated to draw the most publicity possible. So how do you reconcile those two?
Well, I think that she had a political goal. Which was to have the lawmakers enforce the law that was passed by the citizens of Kansas, which is to have the state alcohol free. And so she was calculating toward that political goal in her use of her method of activism that she called hatchetation, which was going into bars with hatchets and rocks and crowbars and other implements of destruction. And she was calculating in the sense that she would pick saloons that she thought would have the most public eye, so to say. So, for example, she picked the Senate Bar, where a lot of the lawmakers would go and have their drinks, and she picked the Cary Hotel Bar in Wichita, which was very luxurious at that time. They had a $1,500 mirror from the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. So she picked sites that would have the most potential for really meeting her political goals and drawing public attention.
So she really was very shrewd. She knew what she was doing and how to get it done.
Right, exactly.
Okay, now you make the point that she really doesn't smash her first saloon, so to speak, until age 54,
right.
But she had quite a remarkable life before that. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, well, Cary Nation was born in Kentucky and, you know, lived through the Civil War, and her family fell into poverty after that, and so she, you know, had to go to work really early. She didn't get to go to school very much as she wanted to, and she got a teaching certificate after a first husband died, a very heartbreak story there. Perhaps we'll talk about it later. After 16 months of marriage, she dies. She's a widow, a single mother. She has to figure out life on her own. After she marries another man, moves to Texas, and their farm project doesn't work out, she's the one who pulls the family out of poverty by starting two hotels that are very successful. Then she starts on a preaching career in Kansas and Oklahoma in a church tradition that historically denied women the pulpit. She was a pioneer in that field, and then she was also a pioneer in another field, osteopathy, which was a form of healing that came to the fore in the 1890s, and she was one of the first women to pursue that as a career. So all of this before she picked up her hatchet.
That's really quite remarkable that she would have gone through so many really careers before she got to what we know her best for,
That's
and
right.
smashing up saloons.
That's right.
Wow. And religion was key to her actions. Tell us how religion relates to what Cary Nation did.
Well, I'll give you a quote. Here's what she told some of her critics. Why do you call me a crack-brained virago for doing what the Holy Spirit has committed? She didn't have a lot of patience for people who were criticizing her, because in her mind, it wasn't her decision to do the smashing, the hatchetation. It was really God's decision. She believed that God had called her to carry a nation to prohibition, hence she even invested her very name with providential significance. But, you know, looking at it from a historical point of view, of course, we can see that as a woman in late 19th century United States, where women were not, where was it culturally allowed, really, for women to go into saloons with hatchets and be violent and speak out with such passion, we can see how she put all of those desires and passions in this religious frame of reference, which made her assertiveness a lot more culturally acceptable.
Was this a personal religious inspiration, or was she part of or caught up in some of the larger revivals and religious movements of her day?
Yeah, that's a great question. There were a lot of religious influences that shaped the religiosity of Cary Nation. Growing up in Kentucky, there was the fervent enthusiasm of the Kentucky revivals, like at Cane Ridge, that kind of spirituality where people are, you know, falling to the ground in trances and, you know, shouting and preaching with such fervence. And then, you know, on the other hand, there's in her home of Kentucky, the Shakers were really a strong influence on her, with their quite opposite influence of severe self-restraint and austerity. She grew up in a family that enslaved Africans, and so we also have a really, really important influence of slave religion on Cary Nation. They were the ones who taught her to shout, which she would do sometimes in the white churches, stand up and praise God and shout her faith out, and that caused quite a lot of conflict with some of the white parishioners that she would be in church with. So she had a lot of religious influences, and the holiness tradition is one that provided the context for what she called her baptism of the Holy Ghost, which was a real marker event for her in her 30s when she was living in Texas.
Can you tell us a little bit about the holiness movement?
Yeah, the holiness movement is a movement that was trying to return to a commitment of personal holiness, and it started, for the most part, in the 19th century among Methodists, and so then it branched out later into different kinds of holiness movements. But Cary Nation was very much influenced by the Methodist holiness strand of that. And, you know, so we see that show up, for example, in her commitment to personal holiness, like abstinence from drinking, abstinence from sex, certain moral principles that she held really closely.
And beyond religion, you mentioned other influences, like, and we can list these one at a time, her father's economic struggles. How did that bear upon her actions?
Well, Cary Nation was a person who lacked a lot of economic privileges. I mean, she was on the margins of American prosperity. She really never experienced that until she started smashing saloons and became this figure who was very popular. But she lived a life of destitution. Her father moved around a lot because, especially after the Civil War, I mean, the family just reached this level of poverty that just never stopped. And so this very much shaped who she was, and she dealt with her struggles very similarly to that of her father, which was by moving around a lot. And you know, people who are stabilized economically tend not to move around a lot. You know, to move around a lot means you're still trying to find that dream. And Cary Nation spent a lot of her life trying to find that dream of comfort that her father always had but never got to find.
Her mother's commitment to an insane asylum?
Yeah, you know, this is a thorny point. A lot of critics, probably most interpreters of Cary Nation, have claimed that the mother was insane, that she believed she was Queen Victoria. And I haven't found a lot of truth to that. It is true that when she was an older woman, the mother was placed in an insane asylum. But as historians know, I mean, you know, to be placed in an insane asylum, especially if you were a certain kind of woman, an assertive woman, a very religious woman, quote, hysterical woman, it didn't necessarily really mean that somebody didn't like having you around. And so Cary Nation lived with the fear that others would consider her insane. And so, you know, we find her really trying to protest that a lot and to claim, probably overdoing it, but to claim that she was not insane. And I think this is another reason why she couches her things in the religious language, that, you know, it's not her deciding to do these, quote, crazy things. It's really God's decision that she do these things.
Now, you mentioned earlier, you referred to her first marriage. She was, in fact, married twice.
That's
Could you
right.
tell us briefly about each of those marriages?
Yeah, sure. The story of her first marriage to Charles Gloyd is quite a tragic story. They fell in love at a young age in their 20s, and it was Carrie's, really, her first love. And the typical storyline goes that her parents hated the guy because they could tell he was a drinker, and what they told Cary was that he would never be able to support her, And so she felt really torn, but ended up telling him, listen, if you can prove that you can support me and children, then I will marry you. So they end up getting married, and 16 months after that, he drinks himself to death. And she never really recovers from that. She didn't immediately pick up the hatchet and go bash saloons because of it, but it really, she carried the mourning of that loss of her first love for a very long time. When she married a preacher named David Nation quite a few years later, it was really for pragmatics and not for passion. Here he was a man 20 years her senior who had several children. He bluntly told her, I need someone to run my house. And she bluntly told him, well, I can do that well, and I need someone to pay my bills. So they made that arrangement. He ended up not carrying his end of the bargain, and she ended up having to pull that family out of poverty with her hotels. So neither one of her marriages was all that fulfilling for her.
Quite a life.
Quite a life.
Now, she became a celebrity abroad as well.
How significant
and how far spread was that?
I wouldn't say it's historically significant. I think it's interesting that a figure like her, you know, this middle-aged woman from Kansas could have any kind of influence in England and Paris, where it showed up the most. In Paris, after her Topeka Crusade started in 1901, there was a mass of temperance women in Paris who blocked the tram line to protest the selling of alcohol in the cafe cars, and they were so successful in the protest that the municipal authority changed the decision and decided not to have alcohol in the cafe cars. I can't see that she ever went to Paris herself, but she did go to England and Scotland and had quite a show there. In fact, some of the shows were so rambunctious, with audience members throwing bottles and vegetables and everything onto the stage, that the Canterbury Music Hall had to cancel a show for fear that it would just bring the house down.
Well, in the few minutes we have left, you mentioned that Nation's crusade, of celebrity or not, was really very personally costly.
Yeah.
Maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I think this is important to point out. I mean, Carrie Nation suffered a lot because of her decision to do this prohibition thing. She was physically beaten, beaten in the streets with horse whips and chairs, and she was beaten in jail. She was jailed over 35 times and made to suffer really awful conditions of cigarette smoke at a constant stream, and lack of food and sleep and visitation. And she suffered emotionally. Her marriage to David Nation ended in a lot of public scrutiny and criticism of her as a woman, that somehow she had failed him. And so, you know, these physical and emotional costs were significant for her.
How did she die?
Carrie Nation's death and the context surrounding it is quite a sad story. It came, I think, beginning in 1910. She started to have a meltdown when her son-in-law took her only daughter, Charlene, away. Carrie Nation had taken over the care of Charlene because she was disabled in many ways. And the husband was an abusive man and came to collect Charlene, and Carrie Nation told a family member, I will never recover from this, and I don't see myself living another year. And in fact, that prophecy did come true. She died about a year later, apparently of heart failure. And after collapsing at an anti-liquor address, she was carried off to a hospital, and her last words were apparently, I have done what I could, which were inscribed on her grave marker.
And perhaps for our last words, I'll just quote from a passage in your book.
Okay.
Carrie Nation's emergence as a reformer underscores the power of tragedy in the formation of a crusading identity. She translated her tragedies into triumphs by making them part of a divinely directed drama. Thank you, Fran, for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Fran Grace, author of Carrie A. Nation, Retelling the Life. This is Talking History.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way.
There are no museums dedicated to Carrie Nation, but there is at least one museum that has many items associated with her, including her hatchets. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Kansas State Historic Authority in Topeka has several items associated with Carrie Nation, the most vicious looking, the Crandall hammer used by Nation in her anti-saloon crusade. She often received gifts of hatchets and weapons from supporters. And along with this hammer, you'll also find fragments from Smash Saloons, her diary, photographs and portraits, and issues of her newsletter, The Smasher's Mail, and other temperance campaign materials. Her purse that she was known to carry little hatchets in is also on display, and a Carrie Nation lecture poster gives you an idea of the notoriety generated by her saloon smashings. The Kansas State Historical Society has many odd and unusual exhibits spanning many years and is well worth the trip for any history buff.
One of the planks in George Bush's campaign platform consisted of a plan for faith-based organizations to provide some of the nation's social services. It was a controversial proposal which stalled after Bush was elected president as more pressing matters demanded his attention. Well, it's back, and the faith-based initiative has led Andrew Schockett to look back to the Founding Fathers for some guidance.
President Bush has proposed, and the House of Representatives has passed, a faith-based initiative. If the Senate also passes the bill, the federal government will help pay for religious institution social programs. Federal funding of religious organizations' good works would enable them to divert money now spent on such activities any way they want. In effect, taxes would be supporting churches, mosques, and synagogues. Many religious leaders back this proposal, but their wisest predecessors fought tooth and nail against state-funded religion. Why? Because when religious groups depend upon the state, they abandon their ability, indeed their duty, to question it. The nation's founders confronted exactly this issue. Many colonial churches were established, depending upon public money. Each colony funded only one denomination. Meanwhile, some evangelical preachers challenged established churches concerning the sin of slavery. They could because their salaries didn't depend upon the pleasure of slaveholders. Politicians. Bush colleagues refrained from biting the hand that fed them, abdicating their moral authority. Little have we learned. The Bush administration's lobbying for its program threatens to produce the same result. This spring, the White House aggressively courted religious groups, especially those that might get funds. Meanwhile, Bush officials pressured some of those groups to drop their opposition to his tax cut. The potential for abuse is staggering. If the plan passes, politicians would be able to link federal funding to church endorsement of morally questionable policies. Revolutionary Virginia knew better. When independence required Virginia to form a new government, the state suspended public payments to the established church. That church's defenders sound familiar. They predicted vice and immorality with the end of state financing. Similarly, supporters claimed that the Bush plan would combat public immorality. But state-funded religion threatens the integrity of religious life, because such money always comes with strings attached. Understanding that, in the late 1770s, Virginia's evangelicals rejected a plan to fund all churches equally, warning that those whom the state employs, it may determine who shall preach, when and where they preach, and what they preach. Those same words apply to the current bill. To skirt First Amendment challenges, the plan limits when, where, and how religious groups may preach or pray in funded activities. Still, some religious leaders nobly tending to poor neighborhoods welcome any help for their needy parishioners and support the Bush initiative. But the faith-based grants would barely scratch the surface of deep needs. Meanwhile, the Bush administration's proposed cutbacks in other social programs dwarf proposed levels of faith-based funding. Other states followed Virginia, and the First Amendment barred a federal establishment of religion. Since then, independent religious leaders have guided the nation's moral compass. Among them, the abolitionist Henry Ward Beecher and Martin Luther King, Jr. American society is richer for past religious leaders' principled resistance to government money. They knew that for religion to be free, it must pay its own way.
You've been listening to Andrew Schockett, Professor of History at Bowling Green State University. Schockett's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we have two interesting television history programs to recommend, both on Roman history. On May 7th, the History Channel will provide us with back-to-back programs on ancient Rome. In the first, the Roman emperors, you'll have the opportunity to examine that period when the power of the empire was concentrated in the hands of emperors who led lives of epic corruption and depravity. You'll have the chance to visit their mansions to get an inside look at the splendor in which they lived and insight into the lifestyle that destroyed the richest and most powerful empire on earth. Immediately following the Roman emperors, watch for Lost Legions of Varus, the story of the battle in which an entire Roman army of 20,000 men was slaughtered by German tribes the Romans had defeated and considered peaceful and Romanized. The program explores the flaws in Roman imperial policy toward the German tribesmen that led to the uprising and the military errors that caused the massacre. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtimes of these History Channel programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian Laveau.
In constant sorrow all through his days, I am a man of constant sorrow. I've seen trouble all my days. I bid farewell to old Kentucky, the place where I was born and bred, the place where he was born and bred. Pleasure.